kpi.org. Oops, okay. Thank you for joining Disability and Progress, where we bring you insights into ideas about and discussions on disability topics. My name is Sam. I'm the host of the show. Thanks so much for tuning in. Charlene Dahl is my research woman. Hello, Charlene.
One.
There you go. I can hear you now. This is Lung Cancer Awareness Month, and Dr. Manish Patel is here with us to speak about this important topic. Good evening, Dr. Patel.
Hi.
Thank you so much for joining us. And I want to just let everyone know Dr. Patel is an associate professor of medicine at the University of Minnesota Medical School and a hematologist slash oncologist who cares for patients at the University of Minnesota Masonic Cancer Center. So thank you very much for joining us. I really appreciate that. Hopefully I'm pronouncing it's Patel?
Patel's my last name, yeah. Manish,
right.
First
Manish
name.
Patel.
Yeah. Pleasure to be here.
Thank you. I want to start out by asking a little bit from you to give us a little bit of history of why you chose lungs as one of your specialties.
That's a good question. You know, I guess I've always been around lungs in a way, in many ways. My dad was a pulmonologist, a lung specialist.
Mm-hmm.
So in a rural town in Indiana. And so often growing up, he would drag me along to the hospital with him. Sometimes I wanted to go and sometimes I didn't. just grew up around a lot of patients with underlying lung disease, not just lung cancer, but So I guess in some ways, as I started my medical career, I was always sort of drawn towards, things that affected the lungs, and in particular, became interested in cancer as a subspecialty during medical school. And coincidentally, my first rotation as a resident was in medical oncology, and I've been sort of hooked since then. So from the very beginning, I've been sort of involved in lung cancer and lung cancer research, and sort of built upon itself as I started doing work in that area.
So we will get into more depth of lung cancer, but can you just give me, like, if somebody were to ask you what is lung cancer, can you give just a brief description of what you would tell somebody?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, lung cancer in a nutshell is really a type of cancer that starts in the lung.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a couple of major types of lung cancer. And, you know, the most common one is something called adenocarcinoma of the lung. And it's just it's a disease that starts in the lung, has the potential to spread to other parts of the body, but it's really a unique type of cancer that really initiates in the lung.
And are there only two types of lung cancer? It sounds like maybe there's more than two.
Well, actually, there's quite a few types of lung cancer. I think there are two major categories which account for probably about 85% of lung cancers. As adenocarcinoma, as I mentioned, is the most common. About 25% of patients have what's called squamous cell lung cancer. And then a much smaller proportion, maybe 10 or 15%, have what's called small cell lung cancer. And then there's a smattering of like five or six different other types of lung cancer that we know about, but they're pretty rare. So those three subsets are really the majority of patients with lung cancer.
So squamous cell, small cell, and sorry, the other one was
non-small cell or adenocarcinoma.
And so are there different symptoms that show in each one?
I think the symptoms generally are relatively the same depending on where the cancer is. And I think that's really kind of a key message around, you know, lung cancer awareness, is that, you know, the vast majority of people when they initially have lung cancer have really no symptoms until it's, you know, starts to advance and cause other problems on other parts of the body. And so sometimes you might be, if you're lucky, you might have some symptoms in the lung, like, a cough, or maybe you cough up blood or something like that, and it shows up very early. And then you can get to a diagnosis early. But for the most part, most patients are diagnosed at a later stage after it's already caused a lot of other problems.
And so give us some example of what some of those other problems might be.
Well, so, generally speaking, and this is true of most cancers, the symptoms of cancer really relate to where the cancer is and what it might be pressing on. So in the lungs, if it's if a tumor has grown to the point where it's causing you to be short of breath, because it's blocking one of your airways or something like this, it's pretty quite advanced because there's a whole your lungs take up a lot of space in your body, and so if you've gotten to a point where a tumor is taking up so much of that space that you can't breathe, it's usually fairly advanced. Likewise, if it's spread to other parts of the body, like it often can spread to the bones, and sometimes that can cause pain. It can often spread to the brain, in which case, it might cause some neurologic symptom. And so, those are the kind of things that that can be indicative of more advanced cancer. And then, kind of broadly speaking, most patients with cancer, if it's spread into other parts of the body, can affect things like your appetite, stop eating, losing weight, those kind of things.
So I'm just curious if you are fairly active, if a person's fairly active, are they more likely to see symptoms early, or does that not really mean anything?
I don't know that, it's hard to really answer that question because I think in some ways, if you're very active, and you may not notice the initial symptoms. And we've heard, doing this for the last 15 years, you hear all sorts of different stories, and sometimes it's like, it's a marathon runner who like suddenly like their time is like, shorter, is longer than what they were used to running a marathon, and they're not really sure why. And then you find out that something like this has happened. And so it's kind of what sometimes these subtle things, but often in those scenarios, if somebody's a marathon runner and they look very healthy, it's very easy to kind of sort of say, ah, it's probably nothing, or like you're just tired, or maybe a cold or something like this.
So I feel like when I look up different cancers, I hear like, oh, this is the most, the highest killer, cancer killer in the US, blah, blah, blah. But lung cancer really kind of is, isn't it?
That's right. We have this dubious distinction of being the leading cause of cancer-related death worldwide. Though we've made some improvements, it still remains the leading cause of cancer-related death, throughout the world.
Higher than breast cancer and some of the big ones out there.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think both breast and prostate cancer occur more frequently. So we see more cases of breast cancer and prostate cancer, but though it's third on the list for the number of cases we see, it still leads the way in terms of of causing death. And that's largely because we don't pick it up very early. And so curing lung cancer becomes very difficult in the when it's advanced.
Do you have statistics, like maybe yearly statistics, how many per year you see?
How many patients per year? I think it's I don't have the exact statistics in front of me. I'm sorry, I
That's
don't know
okay.
the exact numbers. But there's certainly it ranges in the millions a number of deaths per year from lung cancer.
Man, I think when I was young, at least, I always thought of lung cancer is the smoker's disease. I know now that that's not necessarily true. Having a schoolmate actually who never smoked and died quite young from lung cancer, I was horrified to hear when she called me and told me she had it. And since she was so adamant about not smoking. So this isn't always true. So can you talk a little bit about what else can cause this?
You've hit on a really big topic here, that's particularly more so recently. We've noticed over the last 40 or 50 years that the total rate of lung cancer has gone down as we've been somewhat as we've been smoking rates around the world have decreased. But we are seeing an uptick in patients who have never smoked developing lung cancer, and so it's a big issue. And now is, the seventh most common cause of cancer is lung cancer in never smokers. So it is a quite a it is does cause quite a lot of burden on the healthcare system and on society in general, just even this, lung cancer in never smokers. So we don't know, we don't have a lot of definitive evidence of sort of what the cause is in patients who have never smoked. I think what we are now notice, what we now know is that that exposure to radon is a major environmental risk for developing lung cancer, and probably for most people, we think that that's probably the second highest cause around the world of developing lung cancer. We do know in certain populations where there is exposure to a high degree of air pollutants, particularly like if from lower socioeconomic areas where they're inhaling, in kitchens that don't have adequate ventilation, that inhalation of fumes from cooking can be a risk factor for developing lung cancer. And of course, secondhand smoke is also a major risk factor for developing lung cancer as well. I just saw earlier today an analysis that was being done looking at the attributed causes of lung cancer across different parts of the world. And certainly even just air pollution related to industry has been associated with a higher risk of lung cancer in different parts of the world. So particularly like in coal burning areas, the industrial fumes that come from that, there's a higher rate of lung cancer in those populations in never smokers.
Makes me think of like India and China, and I always wonder if
For
they
sure. And I
look at
think those
that.
two places in particular have had a much higher growth of lung cancer, and particularly patients who've never smoked.
I want to talk a minute about genetics, because I believe, if I've done my reading right, that does play somewhat of a role in lung cancer. So you'll have to correct me if I'm wrong, but what role does genetics play in this?
Yeah, so that's a good question. We don't really think of lung cancer as being a hereditary disease, at least not typically. There's not like these large genetic syndromes that are associated with a single mutation that causes that leads to a higher risk of developing lung cancer, like we have for a lot of other, like for breast cancer, they have the BRCA1 gene that puts you at higher risk. We don't really have that in lung cancer. We do know that there are families in which they might be at a higher risk. And I don't think we'd really have the final word on this, but my opinion or hypothesis has always been that there's probably some genetic defect in the way we metabolize pollutants or inhalants that might put us at higher risk than the general population. But we haven't really put our finger on that exactly at this point.
I see.
Certainly, the genetics of the cancer has become very important. And since during the time that I've been in practice, we've become much more, I told you about the sort of the three major kinds of cancer. But within that, there are a lot of different cancers that are based on the genetics of the actual tumor, not necessarily the genes that you pass on to your family member, but the DNA of the tumor itself. That define different subsets of cancer that can be treated very differently.
They talk about a 5-year survival rate. Does this vary depending on the type of lung cancer you get?
For sure, there is a lot of variability around those statistics. I think it varies depending on the type of lung cancer you get. It really also varies on, I mentioned earlier about the genetics of the tumor, and that really plays a big role in sort of determining, the outlook for many patients. I think the other major thing that, that plays a role in the overall survival is the stage of the cancer, such that, if it's fairly limited to just the lung. We often have a much higher rate of overall sort of long-term survival. You know, people get cured of the cancer. I think the big problem with lung cancer is, as I mentioned from the outset, is that, you know, most patients are diagnosed at a fairly advanced stage where it's harder to cure. And so, you know, if they have stage four lung cancer, then that's a much the outlook is much more grim than if it's earlier stage. I think the one thing that is on a very optimistic note is that we're doing better. And there are some, you know, when I started my career, the expected survival for a patient with metastatic lung cancer, advanced lung cancer, you know, was on average about 9 months. And, you know, only about 5% of patients would be alive at 5 years. Today, we've made a substantial improvement upon that, to the point where in some subsets of lung cancer, the average survival is now almost like 3 years, and there are about 15 or 20% of patients that are alive, you know, more than 5 years. And I think, you know, some patients in my clinic now are 10, 11 years out with metastatic lung cancer that are surviving well.
And when we talk about metastatic, we're talking about cancer that has started in the lungs and gone elsewhere.
Correct. Yep. Stage four lung cancer that has spread from the lungs to other parts of the body.
When you do, by chance, get somebody in the earlier stages of lung cancer that hasn't gone somewhere, can you actually cure, or is it just still a prolonged time that?
Yeah, so if a patient gets diagnosed as a stage one non-small cell lung or stage one lung cancer, we often can cure those patients. So probably better than 80% of the time, we do surgery, and depending on the characteristics of the tumor, we may or may not offer them some kind of treatment afterwards. But with that, with the surgery and you know, and with the treatment afterwards, sometimes, you know, 75, 80% of those patients might be cured.
Can you tell me a little bit about why lung cancer cells are less sensitive to available chemotherapy drugs?
I would say, well, I mean, I think it really is very much about the biology of the cancer. And so, you know, when it's not necessarily that they're more resistant to chemotherapy, but I think as we've started to learn a little bit more about the biology of the cancer, we're starting to recognize that, you know, chemotherapy may not be the best, you know, the best treatment for this disease, and that we're, you know, now increasingly are using things like immunotherapy or trying to, you know, get the immune system to kill the cancer. Or depending on the tumor genetics, if we know that the tumor has a particular vulnerability, we can target it more specifically. And those treatments usually work a lot better. So they're much more effective at killing the cancer, and they're also a lot less toxic than chemotherapy. So that's been a really major development in sort of lung cancer treatment these days.
Is there a difference between targeted therapy and immunotherapy?
We generally think of them differently, although I guess I would say that targeted therapy is just using. So, I mean, I guess the distinction between targeted therapy and chemotherapy is that chemotherapy is a little bit like using a sledgehammer, whereas, you know, with a targeted therapy, it's more of a finer tuned instrument. You know, when we're using targeted therapy, whether it be immunotherapy or a molecularly targeted agents, it's just more precise. So it's hitting the tumor where it hurts, and not affecting the rest of the, you know, ha not having so much of the collateral damage.
And do you feel like the targeted therapies are working much better than what you used to do?
Absolutely. There's no question about it. I mean, I think, you know, it really is no longer the case that, you know, chemotherapy does not form the backbone of our therapy these days. So while we might still use chemotherapy, it's not the main player in determining sort of the outcomes. So it's either immunotherapy or the, you know, molecularly targeted agents against a particular vulnerability that the tumor might have.
Well, you hear a lot about organ transplants, and can you not do lung transplants?
No, you can't. I think for most cancers, for most transplants, not even considering lung cancer, when you have an organ transplant, there's a lot of immune suppression that goes along with that so that the body can accept that transplant, and that immune suppression can often lead to disease progression or
Oh, because you
the
can't.
cancer.
Oh, because,
And
yeah.
so for most patients with lung cancer, even though it might be confined to the lung, doing a lung transplant is a huge whack. So it's not something that we think that, and it really doesn't result in cures. And so, putting somebody through a lung transplant and the recovery that's associated with it doesn't really improve their outcome. And in fact, it may make it worse.
How much, if any, of your lung can you lose and still lead a normal life?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good question. I think we have done in some patients, removed an entire lung. One unique thing that most of the listeners may not appreciate is that the right lung actually has much more of the lung volume than the left lung.
Ah.
And so, if you do a left, if you remove the left lung, that's often a lot more easier to tolerate than removing the right lung. I will say, though, that I have a couple of patients in my clinic who have had a total resection of the right lung, even, and have still been able to function and do things. So, in the right patient with he otherwise healthy lungs, this person has been climbing up in the Alps and
Oh my.
doing world travel on one left lung. So, and now I think he's now 8 or 9 years from his cancer surgery. So it is possible in the right patient. Unfortunately, many of our patients that we see are elderly. They might already have underlying lung disease, and so for those people, you always have to take a little bit of a. So there's a very in-depth sort of evaluation of what kind of lung surgery a patient can tolerate. We would only really offer those to remove the lung cancer if we think they can tolerate the surgery.
And presumably, if you do that, can the other lung learn to adapt? Can it actually, the capacity of the lung actually grow,
Yeah, it
strengthen?
absolutely does. So when you take out one lung, the other remaining lung does sort of expand a little bit more. It doesn't completely replace the one that's been removed, but people can adapt to that. It sometimes does take a fairly long time of rehabilitation to recover from that, but many patients can recover quite well.
When they talk about testing, I saw something like PD-L1. What is that?
Yeah, good question. So PD-L1 it's called programmed death one, and it's a protein that's expressed. It's made by your immune system, and then PD-1, and then it binds to this protein PD-L1. And what that does in nature is, dampens your immune system so that, sort of helps prevent your body from your immune system from attacking part of your body. And tumors have become somewhat smart in that they know that if they express this protein PD-L1, that it can shield themselves from the immune system because your immune system wants to get rid of cancers. And so if it makes this protein, it makes it very hard for the immune system to recognize that that's a cancer and needs to be taken care of. And so what the so the reason that we look at that is that the many of the drugs and we refer to as immunotherapy are really targeting that protein, the PD-L1, on the tumor. So now if we block that PD-L1, now the immune system can see the cancer and then learn to attack it.
So let's talk about testing. How is it done?
So the testing for PD-L1 is just done on a biopsy specimen. So if we put a needle into the tumor and take a little piece of it and send it to the lab, they will actually stain it using an antibody to see if it makes that protein or not. There is additional testing that gets done, which is a DNA test that I mentioned before. And so what they will do actually do is take the DNA directly from the tumor and then do sequencing of different genes to see if there are mutations that we can target specifically.
If you stain test, will it still show up if it's not, even if it's not in that part of the lung? Like if it's
That's a
in
great
one part,
question.
is it
So
in
I
the
think
whole
that's
lung?
one of the problems with that testing is that it's really dependent on where you get that biopsy from. And so it's very possible that if we get a very small piece of the tumor that we might miss it. Obviously, or maybe not obvious, but it's sometimes hard to get really big chunks of tumors to look at under the microscope. And so it's one of the things that we're trying to on the research side of things, trying to figure out how do we better predict patients who might respond better to immunotherapy, particularly given that this test is not perfect.
How do you find the tumor in the lung?
Yeah, so usually with a CT scan, a CAT scan or a PET scan, these are sort of in most cases, if it's something that's been diagnosed early, it's because somebody got a CT scan for some other reason, or it brings up another topic, which is screening for lung cancer with the CT scan, which is now something that should be done for most patients at high risk of for developing lung cancer.
So if you're doing a DNA test of the specimen, is that a better test than the stain test?
They're complementary, I think. Usually we would do on any new patient diagnosed with lung cancer, we do test the stain test for PD-L1, but then we also do test the DNA because all of those things we have to put together what's the best therapy for that patient. And so when we get all of that information, we can really make the best kind of decisions.
What kind of things, or I mean, let's say somebody is worried, they have a cough, they've had it for a long time, but, and you know, they don't really have any other things, but they'd like to be checked for lung issues. What do? Can they?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think one thing that I think is important is that as a patient, as a person, what I would tell patients is to really advocate for yourself, in the sense that I think we don't want to create sort of like this mass hysteria that everybody that has a cough, needs to get a CT scan. If you talk to your physician, things aren't right. I've already been on a course of antibiotics and things really aren't getting better. Let's maybe not just assume that it's, lingering cough. Maybe it's worthwhile getting a CT scan to check because things aren't going the way that you expect.
What is normal cough and what is abnormal cough?
I don't think we know. I mean, I think that's the problem, that's kind of the problem,
That's right.
So, if somebody has a cough, that has, I have chronic asthma, and so I
Me too.
cough, after I get a cold, I
I
cough and I
cough all
cough
the
and I
time.
cough, and it takes me like a month before I get better or more. And so, that's kind of been my routine now, and I've had a CT scan, so I'm kind of not like as worried about it anymore. But in these kind of things where it's sort of like, well, things aren't getting better, and you've been prescribed the medicines to get it better, but it's not getting better. These are the ones where we say, like, maybe we should, get a CT scan and take a look. And in fact, my mother was diagnosed with lung cancer in exactly this way. She had a really bad flu case, and she was just like sick for a long time, just wasn't getting better. And she talked to her physician, and they decided together that they would just get a CT scan just to make sure that there was nothing else there. And by the time she had actually got the CT scan, she felt a whole lot better. But she went ahead and did it, and there they found this, mass in her lung. And thankfully she's doing, and she, they caught it early. She had it cut out, and we brought her up here to the university to get it taken out, and she's doing great now.
What a great
So.
story.
So it happens.
So it's interesting. Sometimes I think that doctors go into their profession because they know of someone or have a personal, exposure to something. But yours obviously must have come after, I presume.
That's right.
And
That's right.
now you've been exposed like majorly to this, and so you really know what it's like dealing with something like that. Are there negatives to being a more of an aggressive checker for lung issues? I suppose the
There certainly
cost on
are. I mean, I think
insurance.
there are downsides to doing scans because sometimes we find things that we don't need to know about. For me, I think the lung nodule is a very challenging thing to deal with because lung nodules are very common, particularly in the Midwest. There's a lot of fungi in the soils, and so people inhale these fungi, and they don't cause any problem, but they show up on a scan as a nodule. And so we have to be a little bit careful about how we interpret some of these things, and we don't want to go and biopsy or cut out every nodule that we see. And I think at the university and many large medical centers, we're fortunate in the Twin Cities that we have, really advanced healthcare systems that have been designed to sort of deal with these kind of issues. So if we have, at the university, if we have a patient with a lung nodule, that could be cancer, but it's, not sort of indeterminate. They have a conference that every once a week where they have a team of specialists, surgeons, radiologists, to look at the scan and determine a plan of how they're going to follow that. So then it might be if it's, very small and not very worrisome. Based on the imaging criteria, then they might say, let's do another scan in 3 months. And then there's a nodule clinic where they'll see the patient, give them the results of the scan, tell them what the plan is for following it, and then follow out that plan so that we're not necessarily just blindly cutting out or putting needles into people's lungs unnecessarily.
Obviously, when someone gets diagnosed with a young cancer, in the case of my friend, she had two fairly young children. Well, that was really devastating. What do you usually suggest that they do to get support?
Well, I think it's, first of all, those cases are heartbreaking. It's really difficult. I think, it's hard to really say that there is one right answer in terms of how to support them in that way. I think we do try to put them in touch with other people who have gone through this. There are several organizations around town that can help. We happen to be involved with an organization called A Breath of Hope Lung Foundation, and they're an organization I've been involved with for probably the last 10 years, and they do a phenomenal job of supporting patients with lung cancer, providing support. In our clinic, when we have patients like that with young children, we do get them involved with our, social workers so they can help with sort of how to have those conversations with the children that, mom or dad has a very difficult diagnosis and how to deal with that. I think we also spend a lot of time with the patients focusing on, trying to establish what are the goals of treatment. And for patients who have young kids, often it's sort of like, we often have really difficult conversations about, well, how are we going to maximize your time with your family, and try to avoid making you too sick with treatment, but also trying to give you the best treatment to let you live as best you can and for as long as you can with your young ones and your loved ones.
What's the youngest patient you've ever seen?
26, I believe.
Oh my.
Yeah.
Is there a preference, a gender preference for lung cancer?
Not really. I think as the advertisement that I've often heard, so if you've got lungs, you can get lung cancer, and it really doesn't discriminate particularly in that way.
So, is there a ethnicity preference?
Not really. Again, I think it is very common amongst many different ethnicities. I would say that in the never smoking subset, it may be more common in Asian population and in young women. We don't fully understand that exactly, as far as why that might be.
I
But it
remember.
does, it is, the younger patients more often are women. And also in the Asian population as well.
I felt like many years ago, I went to Japan and I was like amazed. It felt like everyone smoked there. I was like, "What?" But I think it was just maybe where I was, but it felt like there was a large amount of
Well,
smokers.
certainly globally, there's a lot more cigarette smoking across the world than there is in the U.S. for sure, and around the globe in particular, and particularly in sort of the lower socioeconomic countries, there's a really high rate of smoking still. So it's a big worldwide problem, and thankfully we don't have as much cigarette smoking here, and it's partly I think we talked a lot about sort of the improvements in treatments and whatnot, but I think a lot of the reason why the lung cancer incidence has been getting better is because we are, and the mortality from lung cancer is getting lower is because we're, there's a lot less smoking around.
Are there any new treatments you guys are actually looking at but aren't being used yet?
Well, there's a lot for sure. I think one of the really exciting things that we are we're, there's a couple of exciting things that we're working on in particular at the university. One is using immune cells as a therapy for lung cancer. So I talked to you a little bit about using immune therapy to block PD-L1, and that's really the tip of the iceberg, really, in terms of immunotherapy. And we have been very much interested in using immune cells that are either engineered in the lab to be much more focused cancer killers. And so we've got a couple of clinical trials that are going to be starting very soon at the university using cells. So one of them will be taking a specimen from a patient, and the tumors themselves will have immune cells that are within the cancer that are trying to kill the cancer, but they just can't do it. And so, one of the really exciting clinical trials that's been done recently was to actually taking those immune cells from the patient, growing them in the lab, and then giving them back to the patient. And those are really particularly effective. We've seen some really dramatic responses with patients with lung cancer. And so we're doing the next generation of that kind of a trial where we're taking the T cells out of the tumor, modifying them in the clinic to make them even more active, and then putting them back in the patient. And that's going to be starting hopefully early next year. And then likewise, we're using a different type of immune cell called natural killer cells that are targeted against a particular target. And so that's another exciting trial that we've got starting up here pretty soon. And then one other kind of interesting thing that we've been working on as well is trying to understand the way the gut microbiome can influence cancer therapy. And so we have a clinical trial using actually a bacteria pill. That's meant to sort of improve the gut microbiome, the bacteria in the gut, to help improve the response to treatment. And so that's a trial that's actually going to be opening up next week for patients with a new diagnosis of lung cancer.
Sometimes looking at the studies for people who have cancer, it feels like you have to be at a specific stage or a specific, whatever to get into the study. Is lung cancer that same way, or is it kind of, if you've got it, you can get into a study pretty easily?
Well, I think, I tell patients all the time that if they're seeing an oncologist or doctor about their cancer treatment, to ask about clinical trials. So just, and there are every trial has a specific inclusion exclusion criteria, it may or may not be right for a patient given wherever they are in their treatment. A particular trial may not be the right thing for them at that time. I think it's really hard to know what the right answer is unless you ask about it. And if they don't have, if we don't have clinical trials at our site, we'll often say, well, let's take a look and see what they've got down, at Mayo or somewhere else in town, because there might be a trial that might fit for them around there. And I think, it's really important that we do these trials, because that's how we get these advancements in treatment, is really by
Right.
participating in clinical trials and gaining that knowledge that helps us sort of get the next treatment.
Where can people go to find more about lung cancer?
I think there are many sources. I think I mentioned already a Breath of Hope Lung Foundation. They have a patient portal that is loaded with a lot of really great educational resources about lung cancer. They have like an animated display that talks about different stages of lung cancer, different treatments for lung cancer. Certainly on the University of Minnesota website, the cancer.umn.edu has a list of clinical trials that are open and available for patients with lung cancer. And I think if it, just as I was saying before, if you've got lung cancer and you're meeting with your oncologist, I think it would be useful to sort of say, tell that person, am I eligible for a clinical trial, or is there a trial that's right for me? Because I think it's important that we do these things.
Sometimes, when you're, I hate to use it, but sometimes it feels like you can shop for doctors. There's a lot of different doctors around and different specialties. What would you say to look for if you have been diagnosed with lung cancer that you want to make sure you're in a good place? What's the best things to look for?
Yeah, like I said before, I think we're fortunate that, here in the Twin Cities, we have several very good places around the Twin Cities. And I would say all of the major health systems around here have really good people doing lung cancer care. I think really the main issue with, well, for lung cancer, I mean, I think it's really important for patients to advocate for themselves, that we need to have these genetic tests that are being done on the tumor. We need to have PD-L1 testing. So, depending on who you're seeing, most people are aware of this, but if it's not there, at least you got to ask about it and get it done. And then I'd say, mainly I think the other thing that is important is that, this is a life and death kind of a thing. I think the main thing is that you want to feel very comfortable with the person that's in front of you, that you can have a good conversation with, you they feel like they've listened to you, because you don't get a lot of other op you don't get a lot of second chances at this at when you're diagnosed with lung cancer. You got to get it right
Right.
from the beginning. And there's really it's enough of a battle to have lung cancer to then have to also battle with the physician that you're seeing that you're not really clicking with. So if things aren't working out right, seek a second opinion, or even a third opinion sometimes, to get the person that's the right fit.
Is there anything that you would like to see happen in this field, coming
I
up?
think a big thing, and one where we don't do very well right now, is screening for lung cancer. It's a very big problem.
Right.
Screening for lung cancer has been approved by the United States Preventative Task Force for probably almost a decade now. I think 2014 is when it first was approved by the USPTF, but probably only about 50% or 40% of patients who can be screened are actually screened. And screening is not perfect. It's not the end all and be all, but we know we can decrease lung cancer mortality by screening and detecting it early. We have a test that can be done that's safe and relatively easy to do, that can pick up lung cancers early at a stage where we can cure it. And I think if we were able to screen more people, We would certainly do as much good without as much harm as we do with all of this, the great advances we've made. And I'm one of the, I mean, I think I'm very excited about the treatments that we have to offer and all those things, but I would much rather not have to do it because we just don't have that much cancer around.
Are there many false positives with the screening? It's just a matter of seeing, knowing what the
There are for
nodules
sure
are.
false positives. Like I said, on our part, we have to do a good job of like managing those things and making sure that we're not overreacting to some of these things. But I think, as we've had many discussions about this, if anybody would rather know that they had it, and know that there's something there that we can address, rather than finding out too late that there's nothing there. And we have a test that can do that. And there are problems with it, no question. There are false positives, and we may be, doing more scans as a result of that. But then we know we can keep people safe that way.
Dr. Patel, thank you. I really appreciate your time coming on. Is there anything you'd like to leave us with?
No, I think you've covered a lot of ground. I mean, I think the key thing for Lung Cancer Awareness Month is that we're as a group of people, we're aware that this can happen. This is not just a smoker's disease, as you kind of pointed out. And so I think we want to I think that's a message that we want to get out, that this is an important problem for all of us. And if you live long enough, just like I have, somebody close to you is going to be affected by this disease, and so I think it's an important problem for all of us to deal with. So I hope going forward that we'll get a little bit more get more support for doing the research that we do and trying to end this problem for future generations.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks so much.
We'll be right back after this message. This has been Disability in Progress. The views expressed on this show are not necessarily those of KFAI or its board of directors. My name is Sam. I'm the host of the show. Charlene Dahl is my research lady. We've been speaking to Dr. Manish Patel. Dr. Patel was talking about Cancer Awareness Month, and Dr. Patel is an associate professor of medicine at the University of Minnesota Medical School. And he is also a hematologist slash oncologist who cares for adults with patients for patients at the Medical University of Minnesota Masonic Cancer Center. And he's also a lead physician scientist researching on oncolytic virus of lung cancer. So thank you, Dr. Patel. I really appreciate you being on tonight. And I want to remind people that we have a lot of podcasts. So if you have not yet checked them out, please do. And we are archived. Every show is on the archives for 2 weeks, but then it goes to podcasts. And our trusty podcaster, Aaron, will make sure it's there forever. And if you would like to be on our email list, you can email us at disabilityandprogress@samjasmine.com. We'd love to talk to you and hear your ideas.
KPI.org.